All right, here's your full prep for the Fregent Power Solutions meeting. Gary Niederpruem, the CEO. You've got about 45 minutes with him. Let's make everyone count. Here's FPS in 60 seconds. Fregent Power Solutions makes the electrical distribution equipment that sits between the power grid and everything inside a data center, factory, or utility substation. Switchgear, transformers, transfer switches, power distribution units, prefabricated electrical buildings. The one-sentence thesis is this. A private equity sponsor called Neos Partners bought 4 electrical equipment companies in 8 months, bolted them together, spent $205 million expanding manufacturing capacity by nearly 5 times, and took the whole thing public in February at $27 a share. They're now selling into what may be the most severe supply-demand imbalance in the history of electrical distribution equipment. Data center build-out, grid modernization, and an aging installed base are all happening at the same time. Fregent is the rare company with spare capacity in a market where everyone else is running at 75 to 80% utilization with year-long lead times. That's the pitch. Now, the numbers you need to know. The most recent quarter is fiscal Q2, which ended December 31st. Revenue came in at $296 million, up 69% year-over-year. Custom products, which is the core business, was $234 million, up 59%. The powertrain solutions segment, which is the prefabricated modular business, was $46 million, up 230%. That segment has gone from 4% of revenue 2 years ago to 16% of revenue today, and it's still accelerating. Adjusted EBITDA was $60 million, up 51%. The EBITDA margin was 20.4%, which was actually down about 230 basis points from the year-ago quarter, and I'll explain why in a moment. Gross margin also compressed, coming in at 34.3% versus 36.4% a year ago. The primary drivers were about $4.2 million in underabsorbed labor costs and $1.2 million in underabsorbed fixed overhead, plus startup costs at the 5 new campuses. But the headline number is orders. $762 million in orders in a single quarter, up 268% year-over-year and up 66% sequentially. That single quarter of bookings exceeded total revenue for all of fiscal 25, which was $753 million. Let that sink in. One quarter of orders was larger than an entire year of revenue. And management said those orders included one or two deals in the $100 million range, which is the nature of powertrain-scale data center projects. They were quick to note these came from multiple customers, not concentrated in one or two names. Backlog is now $1.5 billion, doubled year-over-year, up 45% sequentially from $1 billion at the end of September. The book-to-bill ratio was 2.6 times. That is extraordinary. And management said they expect backlog to increase meaningfully again in Q3, though order rates will likely come down sequentially from the Q2 peak. For the full fiscal year 26, which ends June 30th, guidance is revenue of $1.275 to $1.325 billion, so roughly 73% growth at the midpoint. Adjusted EBITDA guidance is $300 to $310 million, roughly 80% growth, with margins around 23.5%. The first half of the year delivered $580 million in revenue and $126 million in EBITDA, so the second half needs to deliver roughly $700 to $745 million in revenue and $175 to $185 in EBITDA. That's a meaningful step up, but management has confidence because the backlog is there and the factories are staffed. For fiscal 27, they haven't given formal revenue guidance, but they've said annual EBITDA margins will be, and this is a direct quote, north of 25%. CapEx drops to roughly 1% of revenue, which is a dramatic change from the 11% they're running at now. That's when the free cash flow story kicks in. The street is modeling about $1.86 billion in revenue and $467 million of EBITDA for fiscal 27, with free cash flow swinging from roughly negative $30 million this year to over $300 million next year. Goldman Sachs, which is the most bullish shop on the street, models this thing all the way out to $4.5 billion of revenue by fiscal 30 with $1.4 billion of EBITDA and over $1 billion in free cash flow. And the long-term vision, which they put in the S-1, is $10 billion in revenue by 2035 with 30% plus EBITDA margins. That's the aspirational number, not the near-term guide. But it gives you a sense of how big they think the opportunity is. To get there, they'd need both organic growth and additional M&A, and they've specifically called out services as the primary acquisition target. Services are only 4% of revenue today, and they want to get to 25%, which would be about $2 to $2.5 billion of that $10 billion target. One important margin note for context. SG&A surged 130% year-over-year in Q2, driven by headcount growth, sales and marketing investment, IT build-out, and public company readiness costs. On a GAAP basis, they actually posted a slight net loss of $100,000 in the quarter because of a $10 million write-off of deferred financing costs from refinancing their credit facility in December. Don't let that GAAP loss distract you. The underlying business is healthy. The adjusted numbers strip out about $12.5 million of intangible amortization, $10 million of that financing write-off, $10.5 million in sponsor fees paid to Neos, about $9 million in non-recurring integration and consulting costs, and some smaller items. The margin trajectory from here is the key story. Management says margins will expand sequentially in Q3 and Q4, with 55 to 60% of second half EBITDA weighted to Q4. So the exit rate on EBITDA margin should be around 26%. That's the trajectory you want to probe. Now, the assembly story. This is a PE roll-up, full stop. Neos Partners is a San Diego-based middle-market private equity firm focused on energy transition and critical infrastructure. They raised their first fund, used it to acquire 4 companies in 8 months between October 23 and June 24. The anchor acquisition was MGM Transformers, a 50-year-old transformer manufacturer based in the Los Angeles area. That deal alone was about $400 million. Then they added PWRQ, which makes switchgear and panel boards out of Maryland, then States Manufacturing in Minnesota for transfer switches, then Vantron in Waco, Texas for additional transformer capacity. Total acquisition spend, $604 million. On top of that, they committed $205 million to capacity expansion, adding 1.8 million square feet across 5 new campuses. The combined entity was branded as Fregent Power Solutions in August 25, and they went public on February 5, 26 at $27 a share. Here's what matters about the IPO structure. This is an UPC, which stands for Umbrella Partnership C Corp. The publicly traded entity, Fregent Power Solutions Incorporated, is a holding company. Its principal asset is an indirect controlling equity interest in the operating company LLC. There are 2 classes of shares. Class A shares have both voting and economic rights. Class B shares have voting rights only, no economic value, and are held by Neos and the continuing equity owners paired with their LLC interests. Both classes get 1 vote per share. As existing owners redeem their LLC interests for Class A shares or cash, the Class B shares cancel 1-for-1. There's also a tax receivable agreement, or TRA, where Fregent pays 85% of the tax savings from these redemptions back to the pre-IPO owners for 15 plus years. JP Morgan estimates that adjusting for TRA distributions reduces fiscal 27 free cash flow conversion from 69% of EBITDA down to 57%. That's a real haircut. Total IPO deal size was 64.4 million shares, including the overallotment. Fregent raised about $492 million in net proceeds. Neos sold 39.4 million shares at IPO plus another 8.4 million on the overallotment. Neos proceeds from the IPO alone were over $1 billion. Post-IPO, Neos still owned roughly 82% of the company. The free float was only about 20 to 27%. And there's a 180-day lockup that expires around August 26. Keep that in your head because it matters for the breaking news I'm about to cover. The CEO, Gary Niederpruem, pronounced Niederpruem. He's been at Fregent for about 7 months, joining when the brand launched in August 25. His background is the most important thing to understand about him. He's a 30-year veteran of the electrical distribution equipment industry. He spent formative years at Vertiv, which used to be Emerson Network Power. At Vertiv, he was the chief marketing, strategy, and development officer. He was a key member of the team that carved Vertiv out of Emerson Electric and took it public. That matters because Vertiv is the single most important comparable company in the data center power infrastructure space, and Niederpruem helped build it. He understands hyperscaler procurement dynamics from the inside. After Vertiv, he served as COO at Sasser Family Companies, a Chicago-based railcar and transportation platform, and then as CEO at Synergistic, which does energy efficiency services for large institutions. He guided that company through what they described as a transformation and scaling phase. Before all that, early career at Danaher in product management, engineering, and sales. Notre Dame MBA, undergrad at John Carroll University. This is his first public company CEO role, and Q2 was his first public earnings call. His communication style on that call was confident and growth-forward, maybe slightly promotional, which is typical for a new CEO with a fresh IPO. He said things like, demand for our products is exceeding our expectations, and these are zero-defect products, and our unique value proposition of delivering customization at scale with some of the shortest lead times in our industry is resonating with customers. He's going to be bullish in your meeting. Your job is to probe beneath the talking points. The key thing to understand about him in this meeting is that he surrounded himself with Vertiv and Schneider alumni. The chief capacity officer, Jason Forcier, was COO at Vertiv. The chief organizational development officer, Andrew Cole, was CTRO at Vertiv. The chief commercial officer, Bobby Rogers, ran North America strategic account sales at Schneider Electric for 16 years. The EVP of sales, Tess Knightrook, is ex-Bain with a Harvard MBA. This is a team that came from the incumbents, knows exactly how those companies operate, and is trying to build a faster, more focused version. That's important context for how you frame your questions. Now, the competitive picture. You need to understand where Fregent sits relative to the big three. Vertiv is the closest comp by data center exposure. About $55 billion market cap, running at 75 to 80% capacity utilization, and their Q4 orders were up 252% year over year. But here's the key distinction. Vertiv is primarily in UPS systems, power distribution units inside the white space, and thermal management. They play inside the data center. Fregent plays upstream. Fregent makes the equipment that brings power to the building, the transformers, the medium voltage switchgear, the transfer switches. There's overlap, but they're more complementary than directly competitive. Eaton is the more direct competitor. About $130 billion market cap. Eaton's Electrical Americas segment competes head-to-head with Fregent in medium and low voltage switchgear and distribution transformers. Eaton reported their Q4 last month, and the numbers are telling. Electrical Americas orders were up 16% on a rolling 12-month basis, with quarterly orders up over 50% sequentially. Data center orders specifically were up 200% year over year. Their backlog hit a record $13.2 billion, up 31%. Eaton is investing heavily, over $500 million in capacity expansion across multiple sites, but they're a diversified conglomerate where data center is maybe 15% of total revenue. Their lead times are 6 to 9 months or longer for complex custom work. Schneider Electric is the third big player, about $18 billion in North American revenue, strong in power distribution and automation. Interestingly, Fortune's chief commercial officer Bobby Rogers spent 16 years at Schneider running North America strategic account sales. That hire is both a competitive intelligence asset and a potential source of customer relationships. Here's Fortune's core differentiation claim. 91% of their revenue is engineered to order, meaning custom designed and built for each specific project. Peers are typically at about 10% custom. Custom products command a 500 to 800 basis point price premium over standard equipment. Fortune's lead times are 33 to 65% faster than market averages. Specifically, they deliver substation transformers in 30 weeks versus 85 weeks for the market, medium voltage switchgear in 28 weeks versus 49, and e-house installations in 40 weeks versus 61. They claim they can deliver a 180 megawatt e-house installation in 5 to 6 months, which they call world-class lead times. And critically, they're sitting at less than 25% capacity utilization on a facility base that can support $5 billion of annual revenue. Everyone else is squeezed. Fregent has room. One more competitive data point. Fregent says that about 50 customers account for roughly 90% of the data center market. They currently sell to about 25 of those 50. Their customer skew tilts toward colocation providers and what they call neocloud companies rather than hyperscalers directly. They work with the hyperscalers more selectively, often indirectly through colos and engineering procurement contractors. That's a strategic choice, but it's also a potential limitation on their addressable market if hyperscalers increasingly insist on direct vendor relationships. Now, breaking news for this meeting, and this is critical. Yesterday, March 24th, after the close, Fregent announced a secondary offering. 30 million shares total. 20.7 million from Neos Partners, the PE sponsor, and 9.3 million newly issued by the company. The stock dropped about 5% after hours, from $35.78 down to $34. This is the second major sell down in 7 weeks. At the IPO in early February, Neos sold 39 million shares. Now they're selling another 21 million. Add in the overallotment from February and Neos has sold or announced the sale of 68.5 million shares in less than 2 months. Their total proceeds are probably north of $2 billion. The stock has performed well, up about 33% from IPO price, so they're selling into strength. But the pattern is aggressive. You want to probe this carefully. The lockup doesn't expire until August, so this secondary must have been negotiated as an exception. The question is whether Neos is on a predetermined distribution schedule or opportunistically liquidating as fast as the market will absorb shares. And here's the tension. Neos still controls the board through Class B voting shares. They have majority voting power. So even as they sell economic interest, they retain control. That's a governance overhang. Second breaking item, the NGM Transformers lawsuit. A man named Abby Gadrikian filed suit claiming he's a 50% owner of NGM Transformers and was squeezed out of the $400 million sale to Neos. In October 25, a Los Angeles Superior Court judge denied Neos' motion to dismiss, letting the case proceed. If successful, the exposure could be around $200 million. That's a third of the original purchase price. His lawyers issued a public press release targeting IPO investors before the offering. You want to ask where this stands today? Third, tariffs. Copper now carries a 50% Section 232 tariff as of August 25. Steel and aluminum also have elevated tariffs under Section 232 and the broader Liberation Day tariff actions. Let me give you the COGS breakdown so you understand the exposure. Direct materials are about 70 to 75% of cost of goods sold. Within that, steel is 34% of material costs, copper is 24%, breakers are 18%, aluminum is 11%, and everything else is 13%. So copper and steel together represent roughly 60% of material costs, which is roughly 40 to 45% of total COGS. And here's the important part. Fagent does not hedge raw materials. They rely on pass-through clauses in customer contracts, what they call tariff and material inflation clauses that permit repricing. For mid to large projects, they say customer purchase orders are quickly matched to supplier orders for tight price-to-cost alignment. But the question is how tight those pass-throughs really are and what the lag looks like in a volatile commodity environment. They also have manufacturing in Tijuana, which represents about 31% of their total manufacturing footprint. Under the current tariff regime, USMCA-compliant production from Mexico faces some exposure depending on content rules. Management has noted they can shift production between U.S. and Mexican campuses, but that flexibility has limits. Now, the eight questions that matter, and why each one matters. First, you want to ask about the secondary offering pace, because you need to understand NEO's exit timeline. Is this a structured distribution program, or is the sponsor trying to get out fast? The answer tells you whether the stock faces ongoing supply pressure for the next 12 to 18 months. Second, you want to ask about customer concentration trajectory. Today, no single customer is above 9% of annual revenue, but the Q2 quarter had one customer at 12%. As Fagent shifts toward larger powertrain deals, the $100 million orders they mentioned, concentration could increase quickly. You want to hear how they're managing this. Third, you want to ask about the utilization ramp. They're at less than 25% utilization on $5 billion of capacity. The entire investment thesis depends on filling those factories. What does the hiring curve look like? When do the five new campuses hit steady-state productivity? What's the margin profile at 40% utilization versus 60 versus 80? Fourth, ask about tariff pass-through mechanics. Specifically, are customer purchase orders fixed price or do they include commodity escalator clauses? What's the lag between a copper price spike and when Fagent can reprice? On a $1.3 billion revenue base with no hedging, even a modest pass-through delay on a 50% copper tariff is material. Fifth, ask about the MGM lawsuit status. Where's the case today? Is it disclosed in the current registration statement? What's management's honest assessment of the defense? $200 million in potential exposure on a $600 million acquisition is not trivial. Sixth, you want to probe the low-voltage cross-sell opportunity. This is one of the most underappreciated growth levers. Fortune's ratio of low-voltage to medium-voltage revenue in data centers is 2.2 times. The market ratio is 6.5 to 7 times. Every one-turn improvement in that ratio equates to roughly $400 million in incremental revenue. They're winning medium-voltage deals first because of long lead times, then pulling through low-voltage equipment. You want to hear specific examples. Seventh, ask about technology investment in 800-volt DC distribution. Both JP Morgan and Barclays flagged this in their initiations. The data center industry may be moving toward DC power distribution, which would be a significant technology shift. Eaton and GE Vernova are investing here. Where's Fagent? Are they behind the curve? Eighth, ask about the service opportunity. Services are currently only 4% of revenue versus 30 to 50% at mature peers. The 2035 plan calls for $2 to $2.5 billion from services. That's an enormous gap to close. What's the roadmap? What to listen for during the meeting? Pay attention to his tone when you bring up NEO's. Does he defend the pace of selling or does he acknowledge investor concern? A CEO who dismisses secondary selling pressure entirely is either naive or promotional. Neither is great. Listen for specific language around utilization. You want numbers, not just ramping well. If he says on track without quantifying, push harder. Listen for customer names. In the filings, they list AWS, CoreWeave, Digital Realty, Equinix, Google, Meta, Microsoft, Oracle, and xAI as data center customers. But they don't break out who's driving the $762 million in Q2 orders. If he names specific wins, that's high signal. Listen for how he talks about pricing power. The best answer is something like reliability and safety matter more than price to our customers, and we have the lead times to prove it. That's actually close to what he said on the earnings call, and it's a strong answer. But if he's evasive about commodity pass-through or competitive pricing pressure, that's a yellow flag. And watch for any evasion on the lawsuit or customer concentration. If he deflects hard on the MGM litigation, that tells you something. Finally, the bear case you need to pressure test. The stock is trading at roughly 50 times current year adjusted earnings and 31 times next year. That valuation requires near flawless execution on a ramp that's never been done before at the scale in this industry. The bear case has five pillars. One, the PA sponsor is dumping shares at an accelerating pace, which suggests they may see better risk reward elsewhere. Two, the utilization ramp is unproven. Going from 25% to the 60-plus percent needed to hit fiscal 28 estimates requires doubling throughput at five new campuses simultaneously while training hundreds of new manufacturing workers. Three, customer concentration is opaque. The powertrain strategy pushes toward fewer, larger deals. We don't know who the top five customers are or how sticky they'll be in a downturn. Four, data center capex could decelerate. 47% of backlog is data centers. If hyperscaler spending pauses even briefly, the order intake inflects hard. Five, the valuation offers limited margin for error. JP Morgan's downside scenario puts the stock at $14, which is negative 59% from here, on just a mild growth slowdown to 5% revenue growth. The risk-reward is binary. One last thing. When he talks about the backlog, remember that $1.5 billion sounds enormous, but the vast majority ships within 12 months. If new orders slow, the backlog depletes fast. And the cancellation terms, which escalate to 100% once design is released for production, have never been tested in a real downturn. Nobody's canceled a data center electrical order in the cycle because nobody has enough supply. That dynamic can change. The question you want lodged in the back of your mind throughout this meeting is, what does this business look like if demand growth goes from 70% to 15%? Because at 15% growth, the valuation doesn't work, the capacity sits empty, and the margin ramp stalls. That's what separates a great growth story from a great investment.